This is The Guardian.
I'm Grace Dent, and this is Comfort Eating from The Guardian. A podcast where we pay homage to the lesser celebrated foods in life. Because even as a restaurant critic, I believe the food that matters most is often that snack you cobble together when you're curled upon the sofa. Each week, I ask my guest to lift the lid on what comfort foods have seen them through their lives. Because you can tell a lot about a person from what they eat behind closed doors. Hello, friends. Now, you find me on a chair, sorting through my bookshelves, which are three rows deep. I am chucking things out. Okay, actually, I am releasing them back into the world. Look, I have spent 4 years telling myself I needed a bigger place to live and that life would be better if I just had more space. And I kept saying it and I believed it. And then I realized what I actually needed to do was just get rid of about three quarters of the things that I have amassed during this lifetime so far. How about these cookbooks full of complex 14-stage recipes? I have to accept I'm never going to make these. What about my old cross trainer that I really only use to dry knickers on? It's just an indoor washing line, people. Swedish death cleaning is what it's actually called. It is cleaning out your house through the eyes of the people you love who'd come over after you've died. Which things would they actually take away? What would they want? I'm telling you, they would want absolutely none of my stuff. A few pairs of dangly earrings, maybe. A couple of pairs of shoes. The rest will be going in a skip. Okay, the bookshelves are looking better. Secretly, between me and you, while I'm at it, I am keeping the clever books. I'm putting them at the front so that passers-by think that I am brainy. This bedraggled copy of Chicken Soup for the Soul can probably go into the charity shop, whereas William Makepeace Thackeray's Vanity Fair, I'm going to put this at the front. Look like I'm rereading it again. I've never finished that book. I'm glad I'm doing this now because my guest for today's episode is brainiac broadcaster, host of University Challenge, Amol Rajan. I first met Amol when we both worked at the Independent newspaper, where at the tender age of 29, he became the paper's youngest ever editor, at which point part of his role became to try to make me file my copy on time. The poor soul. Since then, he's been media editor at the BBC, and these days he's the presenter of Today, BBC Radio 4's flagship news programme. Oh, and he's got four tiny children too. What I'm desperate to know is what in God's name does this dynamo eat when the kids are asleep and the microphone's turned off and he's got post-broadcast munchies? I'll just ask him.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Amol Rajan, welcome to Comfort Eating.
I've just noticed one thing.
Go on.
You know, at the end of Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, mm-hmm. where he gets to the end and then the knight goes, I knew you'd come. And he has to choose the Holy Grail. And the other guy, the bad guy, chooses the wrong one. And then Indiana Jones chooses the right one. You've got the Holy Grail behind you. That golden cup. That golden cup, original. That's the, if you drink liquid from that, it heals.
I drink lizard's blood from that once a week. That's how I'm slightly famous. I thought that we all knew that. Have they not asked you?
Hang on.
this is welcome to comfort eating.
It's not just comfort eating, is it? So we should probably start recording, shouldn't we?
Amal, last year you took over from Jeremy Paxman to host University Challenge. The show is the pinnacle of British braininess. It's the bastion of the establishment. It has not changed much over the decades. You're only the third ever presenter. Since 1962, there has been one moment since you began that does suggest that we have entered a new era, a moment that unexpectedly went viral and produced this remix. Hit it.
Can't accept drum bass. We need jungle, I'm afraid.
What a beautiful remix there by Vengeance.
Do you know what? That was just this outbreak of complete wonderfulness. This sample of this answer on University Challenge, which just went completely viral, was so amazing. It was all social. It was no media. It was just people being really nice. It was all like just this outbreak of love and affection.
I'm going to break down what happened for people that didn't hear it or see it. You asked the Aberdeen team to name the genre of dance music that developed in the UK in the early 1990s out of the rave scene and reggae sound system culture associated with acts such as a guy called Gerald and Goldie. Now, they answered somewhat foolishly, drum and bass, and you replied with, I can't accept drum and bass, we need jungle, I'm afraid. And then it all kicks off.
I'm still, even now as I sit here, getting sent videos on my Instagram feed of people showing massive names in drum and bass, like Fabio and Groove Rider. And at these massive gigs, people are playing that. And I sort of can't believe it.
But your insistence on precision in the history of dance music, now this is suggesting something. Were you a raver?
I was a raving nut. For about 6 years, I was a massive raver. I went to university and I met the most amazing people, and I was really worried because I thought I'd be surrounded by really posh people. And I remember turning up in corduroys, mustard corduroys, in this sort of dodgy railway station master's hat. And then I met a load of people from London, and they were massively into the drum and bass scene. For about the next 3 years of university, and for about 3 years after that, I went raving constantly, most weekends, and it was wonderful, and I had an amazing time, and I feel so grateful for my raving years. And one of the things that made this incredible viral moment so special is it really did reconnect me with my former raving self.
Now you're on University Challenge. I don't think you can go to raves anymore because you never saw Bamba Gascoigne at the back of the Hacienda.
I did once see Jeremy Paxman in Ministry of Sound. No, I'm joking.
Now, every week, my guest brings me their secret ladle of love, their treasured hug in a mug. It is their most beloved food, let's be honest. Sometimes it's downright bizarre. Please, Amol, unveil your snack.
I cannot tell you how excited I am.
What we have here is oat cakes. On one side of the plate, though, you've got thick cheese with big blobs of hot sauce. On the other side of the plate, we've got thick, dark chocolate in slabs.
The tiny little backstory to this is, if you grew up in South London, there was a Wetherspoons in Brixton, which I used to go to, and all these Jamaican men would come in with a bottle of hot chili sauce. And there is a chili sauce that I now have every single day, and it's called cold sauce, cold, K-O-L-D. It's a fermented hot pepper sauce. It's amazing. Right, can I have some, please?
Yeah, it's got a...
So I like a really good cheddar, like a Quick's cheddar or a Comté. And,
oh, yeah.
And then a bit of this cold sauce.
This...
Oh, my gosh.
This is a standard in the kitchen
That is unbelievable.
There's something, there must be something
in hot pepper fermented sauce, and definitely in cold sauce, that's addictive. Because once you have a little bit, you need to chase that flavour. I think maybe it's the tingle on your lips.
Yeah.
That slight burning.
I think that this has everything. The guilty pleasure snack needs. You've got the gravelly under layer of carb that fools you into thinking it's a health food. Then you have the thick layer of essentially fat. It's portable. It's got heat. Yeah.
Everyone's got a bit of midnight cheese in them as well. And I know, because of the next thing we're about to have, I know that actually that oat cake with cheese and that chili sauce is a precursor to a kind of pudding.
Well, look, you're one of the only people that's ever brought a snack in two stages. This
makes
is
me feel special.
What's the next bit?
So this is an oat cake with chunky sea salt chocolate. And the reason for it, don't look so dismayed. It's not meant to be funny. The reason for it is that I think the reason for having this is that all chocolate is improved by salt.
Mm.
And if you have an oat cake with a really high quality bit of chocolate, it's basically the poshest Kit Kat you've ever had. Well, may you laugh, Ms. Dent.
I put on a nice frock for you, and now I've got a fermented chili stain right down my right boob.
Oh my God, you have it all.
I really have.
The oat cake has a little bit of salt in it, and it has a kind of umami twang. It has a kind of, you know, once you're going with it, it has this kind of binding, salty connectedness. Do I sound like I'm talking complete bollocks?
I want sorry, mommy twang at Reading. Let me take you back now, Amol, to your childhood. You were born in 1983 in Kolkata, in the east of India. But when you're three, your parents make a huge decision. They leave India. They leave everything they know, and they up sticks to London. First Chiswick, then Tooting, where you settle. Why the move?
It's kind of dawned on me how absolutely nuts and how improbable it is to get to the age of 40-odd, as my parents were, and leave everything behind, go halfway across the world where you don't know anyone, you speak the language, but you've got no mates, foreign land, no real idea what you're doing, and you do it for one reason only, which is that you want a better future for your children. I've always felt that my parents' sacrifice, not just my dear dad who's no longer with us, but my mum as well, in coming to this country was something I had to repay.
So your dad was in India and did he see a job that was here? Did he apply for a job?
He was a bona fide genius. He's extraordinarily, unusually, intellectually brilliant at maths from a very, very poor family. He's one of 11 children. He had six younger sisters, had to get them all married because that's how he did it in those days. He went off to North India to live a solitary life. And then his brother said, Mum's really worried about you not getting married. You need to get married. There's this lovely girl in the ammunitions factory where I work. And that was my mum. Married my mum. I think he went for the Indian Civil Service. And then he also got into this bank, which was a state bank called UCO Bank. And then he actually got a posting to London.
So there's you, your brother, and your mum and dad. Tell me a little bit about family life. What's cooking? When do you eat?
My mum and dad were from very, very different parts of India. My dad's from Tamil Nadu in the southeast, where the food is almost more Korean. It's idli, sambar, rasam, dosas. It's hot, it's sour, and the main staple is rice and lentils. My mum is from West India. Wait, stop salivating. My mum's from West India. It's Maharashtra, so near Bombay. The food is much more wheat-based, but the curries are very different. They're often slightly more liquid. And my mum was astonishing at cooking both those different, entirely different cuisines, different ingredients, different techniques.
How did she learn the other? She married your dad and then she was like, get me a book, get me the aunties, let me
learn. I think women in those, and it's amazing, it makes me emotional thinking about it. I think they were just expected, to some extent, please their husbands in the kitchen. They were expected to provide and expected to learn. And my mum worked. She worked full time. She was a dinner lady. Then she worked in a nursery. And then she ended up in admin at the Foreign Office. But my mum was just expected to do that. And my God, she did it incredibly. So there would be just the most amazing suite of curries. You'd have a cauliflower curry and a paneer curry. And you'd have okra or lady's finger, as it's sometimes called, or an aubergine curry. You'd have this amazing set of curries.
Every night.
Every single night.
But this is so much work.
I hope you're listening to this, mum. I'm so... unbelievably grateful. I mean, if you think that she was working at a nursery, she'd finish at 4 o'clock, she'd come home, everything you could ever want was there, and she would rustle it all up. And then at the weekend, on Saturday morning, down the bottom of my old road at Lessingham Avenue, there were two institutions. One was the Mayfair Snooker Hall, and then there was Daily Fresh Foods. So we'd go in there and Mum would be looking at just this abundance, overflowing baskets of all the freshest produce. And my mum had that thing, which a lot of Indian ladies have, of they pick the best stuff, the ripe stuff. So they're kind of, you know, looking, you do it with an asparagus, I guess, or an okra. You bend it to see if it's going to snap or not. And then you chuck away the ones that aren't quite right. So you'd pick out the best produce. I now realise, A, how much work she would have put into it, and B, that I was just conditioned to expect exceptional food. And I just think, my God, what an extraordinary woman.
Did you have any nicknames at home?
Yes, I did. I'm a big fan of nicknames.
What's your mum call you?
My mum called me Hapus. Hapus was a type of mango. I love mangoes. She would call me Hapus. And
does she still call you Hapus?
She does, yeah. She does. No one calls me a mole. I mean, it's really weird. I play cricket.
Hang on a minute. Well,
no one calls me a mole.
Does everybody call you Hapus?
No one calls you Hapus. Now, you wouldn't get Nick Robinson and Justin Webb being like, okay, time for the news with Hapus.
Let's talk about you at school. Curiosity seems to have defined your entire career. Was there any signs of the direction you were going to take as a kid? I cannot gauge what you were like at school. You were either at the front and got straight A's, or you were expelled.
I wasn't expelled. No, none of the naughty stuff happened till much later. I was quite a straight A guy, but I got B in GCSE geography and food tech, and never lived it down because food tech was my best subject, man. And geography, I was wicked at my Oxbow Lakes. Anyway, I've never lived that down. I wasn't a swot, but I loved school. I loved learning. I really, physics and maths are my big subjects. But there's a weird thing about me in school. I was totally absent emotionally, because all I wanted was to be a cricket player. And I devoted my entire childhood, really, from about the age of 10, 11, when Shane Warne, the amazing Australian, burst onto the scene, and I just wanted to be Shane Warne, to the age of about 17, when I just wanted to be a cricket player. So I was a very dreamy child, really dreamy. I was like fantasizing about bowling leg spin for England and fantasizing about all this stuff. So I feel like journalism is something I sort of stumbled into. Slightly like a drunk man stumbles into a pond.
In 2002, you apply to read English literature at Cambridge Uni. Your parents have moved across the globe 15 years earlier, driven by ambition for you and your brother. So this is a seminal moment in all of your lives. Do you remember the acceptance letter arriving?
I was at home on my own. It said, with a stamp, Downing College, Cambridge. And my mum and dad, I'm going to start crying as I relate this. My mum and dad had a little prayer room in their bedroom. You know, it was a two-bedroom house, me and my brother shared. In their bedroom, they had a little prayer corner bit where we had a landline phone. And I went up there to the prayer bit because it was obviously quite important. And I told myself, whatever happens, you know, I'm going to be all right. I definitely really wanted to get in. And I remember the first words were, following on from your recent interview, we're delighted to offer you a place. And I rang up my dad. And
where was he?
He was at work, and
what's
it was, I can't remember the specific words, but it was definitely the proudest moment of his life. And it meant everything to him. And actually in recent years, and I've thought about this a lot since my dear dad died, you know, you cling on to the things that you did that would give them comfort. And you ask yourself, was I the son I could have been and should have been? But I know he derived enormous satisfaction from that. And it was amazing.
Apart from your love of ragga, jungle and drum and bass, what else did you discover at Cambridge?
I did English literature. I was so interested in other subjects. I was so interested in, still am, in philosophy, politics, history. You had this sudden realization of who actually runs the country. You have this sudden awareness that educational institutions can have this august history. And you feel this sense that you can belong, or this sense of membership within a country's traditions and culture, which historically has been more the preserve of people from a richer background.
I'm fascinated about you. After you've graduated, you join the Channel 5 chat show, The Right Stuff, as a researcher. I remember you popping up on screen.
Really?
I remember the first time I ever saw you.
Really?
Yeah. Where was it filmed? In that shopping centre?
Shopping centre in Bayswater. And I ran it as a sort of social services because my job was to be the on-screen audience researcher. So The Right Stuff, basically, as Matthew Wright would say, it's a radio show on TV. You panel round to an audience and there's meant to be like 30 people there with me in the middle to like stick a mic in their face and say, what do you think about Jordan's, you know, latest headline, or what do you think about Iran getting the nuclear bomb? And it was always very difficult to get 30 people together. Actually, my successes in that job.
Some of those people in that audience as well, they are
homeless. They're homeless. And they basically were there because they thought they'd get their travel paid. And I would literally be outside Whiteley's at 8 a.m. begging people. I'd like having the chat. I was wearing the Right Stuff t-shirt with my little headset, wandering around Bayswater and Queensway in West London, being like, please, 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 will you come and be in this live TV audience? And there'd be like groups of American tourists. I'd be like, yeah, sure. Love to do that. Hey, Ralph, come on. This guy, he's saying, you got to come to this. There's a TV show. It's called The Right Stuff. Yeah. And it was just surreal.
You did make that part your own though, because I remember you were on screen a lot.
Yeah, and especially on a Friday, because on a Friday, 10 to 10:30 was a little sex clinic with Miriam Stoppard, and me and Corinne, who is the girl behind the booth, would have to do these little cartoon Dear Deirdre kind of like cartoon strips. And it would always be about me having bloody erectile dysfunction. And it was like, what is it about? Stop laughing over there. What is it about? Why are you looking at me and thinking, erectile dysfunction? It would always be like me and be like, yo, Corinne's the beautiful, like it was quite a stereotype. She's like tall and blonde and attractive. And here's this like little Indian shrimp who can't get any attention from any girls anywhere. And I was like, guys, this is a bit close to home. And Miriam Stoppard would come in and be like, so Amal, what I think you need to do, you know, if you've got it, her advice about erectile dysfunction, by the way.
What is the advice?
Always the same. She always said the same thing. She's take sex off the table.
Take sex off the table.
She said it's
because... I mean, I think trying to do it on the table is probably where you're going wrong. It's very ambitious.
I realised as I was saying it. That is pretty ambitious, especially as you
just
get older.
Just exhausting.
I know, exactly.
Doing it in bed, Zad. No, come on.
I love doing that show and I learned a lot. And then the editor of The Independent, a guy called Simon Kellner that you and I know, came on the show and I walked up to him and asked him for a job. And the rest, as they say, is history.
You saw Simon Kellner on the show and you walked up and asked him for a job.
As he was leaving, he had to walk past me and I was in the way. And I said, about that thing. And he said, why don't you email this guy? And I did email them.
In 2013, age of 29, you're appointed editor of The Independent.
Stop smirking. Stop smirking, Grace Dent.
I'm not, I absolutely am not smirking. I'm kind of beaming because, look, you were 29. You're appointed editor of The Independent by Evgeny Lebedev. You are the youngest ever editor and the newspaper's first non-white editor too. This is an enormous moment. I'm going to bring it back to food. These are really long, hectic, endless days. What are you eating?
A lot of pistachios. At the age of 29, I had a PA. And Denise Thompson, legendary figure, what amazing, extraordinarily effective, competent, kind, generous, wonderful, wonderful human being. She would often say, Amal, you're covered in pistachio shells. I was eating a lot. I was in my late 20s and then early 30s, I had such full-on days. Do you know what a normal day would be? Wake up at 5 o'clock, do some work at 5:30 in the morning, do a bit of work, maybe write a column, because I wrote several columns a week, one for The Eye, one for The Evening Standard, food column in The Independent on Sunday. Sometimes do Lorraine. I review the papers on Lorraine's show at 7:40, 8 o'clock, meet a cabinet minister in the Wolseley. And, you know, it's absurd. I was 30.
And who are you meeting?
People in politics, generally. And sometimes business.
I'm going to role play. It's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You're in the office. You haven't eaten anything. Denise has spotted this. Amal, You haven't eaten. What can I get you?
I would sense that she would mother you, though, a little bit.
Yeah, she was. Yeah, there was a bit of that.
What did you eat?
I'd have sandwiches. So my kind of sandwich is a BLT. I feel very strongly about BLT that you should have rocket instead of lettuce. Not that I was going to mess about. Sorry? Rocket, the peppery bite and tang of rocket instead of
rocket
the...
Rocket is just a cruel joke.
Oh,
Grace.
It is Satan's salad.
Ruptured our relationship there.
Like, that, what's that in the back of my throat?
How can you defend
lettuce? It's like the pubic hair of the salad bowl.
Whereas lettuce is rabbit food. Take your rabbit food away from my salty bacon and mayonnaise. What was I like as a boss? That's what I want to know. Come on. What was I like?
I think I always at some level felt I was your boss.
Maybe that's why it works. Maybe that's why
never
it works.
Seriously, I think, and at all,
yeah,
ever.
Yeah.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
One of your former colleagues at The Independent has recently described you as extremely talented, fiercely ambitious, a relentless networker, and a good guy. This winning combination gets you snapped up by James Harding, the then BBC's Director of News and Current Affairs. You become the BBC's media editor and presenter of the media show. How was the transition from Fleet Street to the BBC?
It was a hell of a learning curve. It was exciting. And as with becoming editor of The Independent at 29, I was really lucky with my timing because the 6 years that I was covering media and technology was 6 years when Facebook and Google in particular were really in the news. The only thing I'd take issue with that in terms of that description is relentless networker. Never thought of it. Maybe I was an accidental networker, but I never sought to go to those parties. I think, like you, I found them so incredibly awkward and I just hover at the back looking at my Twitter feed instead. But one of the things about the BBC, the transition which you asked about, it coincided with a very major life change, which is that I became a parent. And suddenly it was not about me and suddenly my priorities had changed. And don't always talk about this very much in public, though I've mentioned it a couple of times. You know, my wife and I were going through hellish medical treatment to try and have more children. And that was really exhausting. In fact, the whole time I was editor of The Independent, we were going through, you know, really tough stuff. And obviously we've ended up extraordinarily blessed because we've got four kids. And I really do realize how lucky we are.
I remember talking to you.
About IVF and all that.
Yeah. And it was almost like you were finding the whole thing not only really hard, but it had got to the point where you thought it wouldn't happen. And then I turned my back for 2 minutes and you have four.
Well, we were told it wouldn't happen. That was a thing. There were years and years and years and years and years and years in which it was really tough and a struggle. So there was a lot of that going on when I was at the BBC.
You're a presenter on Today, Radio 4's flagship news programme now. We're talking at 1 o'clock. In the afternoon. What time are you going to bed at?
Well, I'm not presenting tomorrow.
Oh.
I've got a big problem here, which is that I've developed really serious insomnia. I had this sort of massive panic attack before my first stint on the Today programme, and it's gotten better since then, but I very, very often do the show having not been to bed, but having had a sleeping pill. By the way, let me just reassure people.
I can't believe you're having a sleeping pill. Honestly,
well,
darling,
well, you develop all these coping mechanisms and what they call safety techniques.
I'm not judging. I'm worried. That is like
dreadful. But then you become. I'm not addicted to them because I could do it without them.
Yeah, but that's what Michael Jackson said. And in the end, he had to be injected with actual
general anaesthetic.
Yeah, in the end, he was having anaesthetic.
Yeah. So it's a big thing, and it's partly because I've got four young kids. I actually do just wake up very regularly. So the answer to your question is that I try to go to bed. I'd like to go to bed between 8:30 and 9. Mm-hmm. Realistically, if you've got four kids, just the maths of it is that you're going to be up five or six times because they're getting up because they've had a bad dream, a nightmare, or because they've wet themselves, or because they just wake up, or because they've, you know, need a nappy change, whatever.
What are you eating and drinking to survive this schedule? Is this where the oatcakes come from?
It's where the oatcakes come in. So if I eat before today, I will end up eating almost 1,000 calories more on that day. So I try very hard not to eat before today because I can do without breakfast. So on today, I mainline tea. So I have about 3 cups of tea. I have 3 tea bags and 3 sweeteners. And a dollop of milk.
That's soup, darling.
That's soup. It is soup. It's chai. It's wannabe chai. If someone could make me a delicious chai, but then the Indians, they put so much sugar in, and I prefer sweetener. Anyway,
oh, I love that chai though.
Cardamom and vanilla and cloves. And so I have 3 cups of tea and a coffee, and then I try very hard not. I change my cycle route on the way home to make sure I don't go past certain institutions. For instance, there's a new Gales on Great Portland Street, and that's a real problem for me. There's also, at the top of Great Portland Street,
Gales is just the crack den of the middle classes.
Oh, tell me about it. But have you
come in and have an olive bread. Have you tried the almond croissant?
I can't tell you. Here's a lovely chocolate and tahini bite, which costs whatever, but
£7.
It's amazing. So I change my cycle route to go through Regent's Park, and I try and keep my eyes closed despite being on my bike. I'm joking. And then I get home and I just try very hard not to mainline any carbs. So I eat, this is embarrassing, isn't it? I eat cashew nuts, roasted and salted cashew nuts, and dates.
You eat like me in a way that you're eating a lot of things out of the packet, just walking around.
I'm not cooking.
Like a giant squirrel.
Exactly. I want convenience. I want it there in the thing. And if I do that, because I then try and sleep for a couple of hours, which doesn't always work, but then I'll have got to 12 o'clock and I'll almost feel normal.
One of the most talked about BBC programmes you've made was The Princess in the Press. It examined the relationship between the UK press and the royal family. This got you a drubbing in the tabloids, saying you were very disloyal and anti-royalist. Where do you stand on the royal family?
Mind if I just finish that cheese?
Yeah, I do.
I have no problem with the BBC idea of impartiality. So I'm genuinely somewhere between agnostic and impartial about it. I really, really am. But I really do feel it's important within that prism to be able to ask really interesting questions about, for instance, why Prince Harry has a certain relationship with the press, Prince William has a very different relationship with the press. I think of that issue as I think of how I would vote, which is, since joining the BBC, I go along to the ballot box, I write a little note saying thank you for participating in our democracy. You know, a generation of women and men died so that we could have the vote. And I'm not going to vote for any particular party.
You go to the community hall that smells of
vomit.
Smells of vomit disinfectant. And you've got a chance of catching a verruca or something when you're there. And then you write a little note to it. See, this is a bit like the rumour that you touch the feet of the statue of George Orwell, which sits just outside BBC reception every morning?
So the touching the feet of Orwell, who is a hero of mine, is about reminding myself of a few things. One is, it reminds me that there is a real moral purpose, which sounds, I know, fantastically highfalutin, but there is a real moral purpose to journalism, which I know might sound ludicrous as I stuff my face with fermented chili sauce. But if you're going to be a journalist, do it because you think it's important. It reminds me that I'm literally sitting on the shoulders of giants. And it's also a kind of Indian thing of respecting your elders. It's a sort of respect for that which has gone before.
Do you think your disloyalty to the royal family may have messed up you getting your knighthood?
I think that's going to be a major issue. And I think it's going to really impede my ability to get accepted by the establishment.
I bet you've been to Buckingham Palace.
I haven't.
You've never been to a garden party?
I've been to many garden parties, not any royal ones. I shouldn't say this because I should sort of wait for it to happen, but I'm definitely one of those journalists who would, I just think in principle, maybe this isn't very impartial, but I just don't think journalists should accept baubles.
Well, they shouldn't I think journalists, if they offer me a damehood, I will walk that in my bare feet. We are having such a lovely time talking. I'm already overrunning. I promise you that we're getting right to the end now. You met your wife, Dr. Charlotte Faircloth, who is an associate professor in social policy at University College London, at uni. Was it love at first sight?
It was, I fancy her a lot at first sight. I think she was probably more intrigued with me than
Do you remember the first time you saw her?
Yeah, of course.
Come on, tell me.
I saw her a few parties before I chatted to her in that classic way that you'd see someone across the room. And I just thought she was unbelievably buff. I mean, I just thought she was ridiculous. I still fancy her.
What did she look like?
She has
amazing... This was like the first time you ever saw her.
So the first time she was wearing a striped black and white kind of... makes it sound like a zebra, but it wasn't. It was a subtle black and white... jumper. She was sitting on a windowsill in a party at a mate's room. And then the first time we really spoke, I don't remember what she was wearing, but we had a long chat about all sorts of madness that she was studying. And I remember the first date we had, which was in London's Old Street, and we went to a pub called The Angel, because that's the kind of guy I am. She was wearing a purple jumper, which was, she's gorgeous. She's absolutely amazing, most amazing person
I've ever met. Did you feel like you were punching
above my weight? Yeah, I feel that very acutely on a daily basis. I feel like a kind of sort of featherweight, bantamweight character mixing with the sort of, you know, megastars.
But somehow you have fooled this woman into having four kids with you. They're all under 8 years old.
I must have amazing chat, hey? I mean, there must be something that she sees in me beyond my extreme good looks and kindness and all the rest of it.
Charlotte's research looks at gender roles within families.
Oh, yeah.
How does this play out when it comes to splitting childcare and domestic duties?
Well, it feels like I'm permanently part of a massive sociological experiment, which will soon get written about, which is absolutely no basis for a marriage whatsoever. The division of labour is close to the surface, and I think that it is something that has, even more so than would otherwise be the case, encouraged or maybe forced me to be even more determined to be the best sort of dad and husband in the world that I could be, which I know sounds tacky, but she's really, really helped me understand some of the fundamental injustices of like modern history or ancient history, which is the amount of unpaid drudgery that women do, the way in which even if you outsource that unpaid drudgery, there's still a huge amount of the emotional load, the thinking, the bureaucracy that a lot of women end up doing. And she's made me think very, very hard about the way in which we need to try and redress that.
Do you notice when there's no milk in the fridge and buy it?
That's never the case.
Have you ever, of your own volition, written a birthday card for anyone in the family and posted it?
Oh, all the time. Keep going. Have I put away a pile of socks?
Do you put the bin bag out or do you walk past it thinking, oh, there's the bin bag?
I put bin bags out.
Do you pair up socks?
I pair up socks. So I try and I probably don't get to 50-50 of the laundry, but get close to it. I do most of the dishwasher stuff. By the way, I say two things. One is I still think despite my best efforts, she probably definitely does do more than me. And she also carries more of the emotional load of just planning stuff. But I do think there's been a massive, massive, massive generational shift. And I don't, by the way, expect any plaudits or, dare I say it, baubles for this. I do think there's been a massive, massive change in what is just expected and what's reasonable for men to do. When I emailed a few people at work being like, I'm about to have a third kid or fourth kid, it was so interesting the amount of men who responded with the same refrain, the same joke, which as they said, and these people in the 70s, 80s, they would always respond with the same line, which was, oh, I found when a third kid came along, I was having a lot of board meetings in New York. And it's just so interesting because I must have got half a dozen messages like that. I don't know how to respond to that because it's like, oh, right. I'm not saying they were bad dads, they're of a particular generation, but I'm like, I really want to be around.
Tell me about the breakfast shift at your house.
Oh, God. Well, there's about three attempts at breakfast shifts. There's a whole thing about trying to get them all to sit on their bottoms and have their food. There's a lot of Weetabix gets had.
Do you do porridge?
I love porridge.
I love porridge.
Have you discovered porridge like relatively recently in your life?
Yeah. I would eat porridge 3 meals a day.
Okay, if you had one bowl of porridge left, yeah. What would it be? And also, is it milk from a cow or is it oat milk?
I'd put a little bit of milk in, a little bit of water, a little bit water. Of salt. A little bit of water, a little salt. Bit of salt.
You
I'd
Scottish,
make it in
Scottish
a rice cooker. You can put it in the rice cooker, just walk away.
Can I tell you a little bit about how I have porridge?
Please tell me.
Okay. So quite a high bowl. Right, not kind of one of those flat round ones. I want a high bowl because I need height. And the reason I need height is I have porridge with four very distinct quarters. In one quarter, I'm looking after my gut health with the old flaxseed, chia seed. Is it chia or chia seed?
Chia
seed, pumpkin seed, mix of mashed up, milled, whatever. That's one quarter. The other quarter is hardcore berries. I've got blueberries going on, I've got blackberries going on, I've got raspberries, like a lot going on, sometimes some strawberries as well. Then the other quarter is a combination of dates and, get this, tahini.
Okay.
And then the fourth quarter, and this is where the porridge could be absolutely piping hot, is I kind of immerse deep down like three or four massive squares of really posh chocolate. Like either chili chocolate or chocolate and orange or chocolate and sea salt. And then what you do is as you're having those other three quarters, I kind of stir from the bit with the chocolate so the chocolate kind of becomes this kind of swirl through the porridge. And then by the end, you've got this, it's almost like Cocoa Pops. It's like, it's my version of Cocoa Pops makes the milk go chocolatey.
What do the kids say about this?
They don't see it. This is my secret comfort eating. When I get back from the Today program, I've had 2 hours sleep and then I just want to just lose myself. One of the reasons I'm very conscious that I've punched above my weight with my wife is that I don't think I'm a very attractive eater because I love massive mouthfuls. I mean, you've probably seen a few of them here and got them on tape. I like to really shovel it in. And with these bits of porridge, I'm just like, getting these massive ladles of porridge, and the kids wouldn't see me do that.
Now you've got four kids. How do you keep the magic alive with your wife? Do you go anywhere special for dinner? Do you ever get out of the house?
Big time. That is a really important thing. It's the most important relationship in any family, I think, and it's one that's most easily neglected. So we're trying very hard. It's been tough because we've got four kids and one's very young, but we're trying very hard to institute date night.
Okay.
But I've got to be completely honest that I've got a dilemma and I almost don't want to admit this because I think I'm going to come down on the wrong side of this dilemma. But on the day that we're having this incredibly enjoyable conversation, we're meant to be having date night tonight. But as it happens, it's not going to be that easy for one of our babysitters to get there until really quite late, so we could scrap the date night. And I don't have a social life at the moment because I've got young kids. I've been invited to the premiere of the Bob Marley movie. And I know James Norton a little bit, the actor, and
friend of the podcast.
Has he been on?
He came on here.
James has been on?
Yeah.
In this very chair.
I don't remember anything he said at all.
Is that what you're going to say about me as well?
No, he was lovely. Very funny.
Apart from being lovely, he's a genuinely, deeply decent guy. Anyway,
he's in it. Right. So basically, I'm cutting through this. Your babysitter's let you down.
I think I'm
going to
go, but my wife's not.
Date night can't happen. You're going to go to a premiere by yourself.
Which I've never been to. I'd never go out. This is such a rare thing. But it is Bob Marley. Bob Marley is my hero. And our youngest daughter is called Nesta. And Nesta, by the way, is Bob Marley's middle name.
It's nice, though, that we've documented this for when you get the divorce.
Exactly. The lawyers will be sort of, yeah, presenting, yeah. The solicitors will be writing to each other saying, well, there's this recording with Grace Dent where you did on this one occasion. So I think on the dilemma, I think because my wife is amazing, was like, it's a Bob Marley film. You've got to do it. So I should probably go.
This sounds like shit that you like shout through a letterbox when you're locked out.
Via your solicitor.
Where would you go for some peace and quiet and nourishment?
One of my closest mates is a guy called Jackson Boxer. Mm-hmm. And Jackson runs, I think, London's best restaurant called Brunswick House Cafe. But we have this amazing tradition. And I, even as I say this, I know how blessed I am, which is the week before our babies are due, when my wife has finished work, she always tries to finish work with that little bit of a gap. We'll go for a long walk across London, talk about everything. And we end up at one of Jackson's restaurants, either in West London or in South London. And it sort of accidentally happened. He would just, I'd tell him it was happening. And he's so gregarious and so generous that he would just cook for us. And honest to God, in August, just before our newest baby was born, he cooked this sort of 7-course meal out of nowhere at Brunswick House Cafe. And it was the best food I've ever eaten. Mm. That's me and Charlie's place, Charlie, my wife. But also, if I had a last meal, it would sort of be wherever, but Jackson cooking for me. Because that's what food's about. It's about other people.
Finally, ambition-wise, what are you dreaming of? What's your dream for the future?
As I've tried to be in this entire wonderful recording, I'll be completely honest with you, which is to say, I really think we've got two careers, right? We've got a material career, which is what's on your CV. It's positions you hold, jobs you have. And then we have a moral career, which is basically how do you spread love. And I know it's a really weird thing to say, but I put in genuinely 10 times as much thought, planning, time, effort, resource into my moral career. But then one of the few kind of things that I'd like to do in public life is the model that me and my mate had for our charity, which is a summer school for kids. I'd like to reestablish that and really take it up a level and scale it. If I did that and I could help hundreds or thousands of children every year, from humble beginnings, break into elite professions. That, I think, would be a life well lived.
Thank you for comfort eating with me.
So fun. Did you really think you were my boss?
Yeah. Yeah.
This episode of Comfort Eating was produced by Ruth Abrahams. The executive producer is Lucy Greenwell. The music was written by Axel Cacoutier. Visuals by Sophie Harrow. Mixing and sound design by Solomon King. If you love this podcast, then you'll love my book, Comfort Eating. It's a slice of joy, sprinkled with nostalgia about my family, stories of the making of this podcast, and recipes which will leave you, well, frankly, bewildered. Finally, go on, leave us a review, and you can follow or subscribe so that you never miss an episode.
This is The Guardian.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.